Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and guess what? You get an extra day to complete your homework this week for our financial education series, Money U. We've been talking so much about national finances today and city finances. Well, Deyanira Del Rio, who's been joining us every week this month, will be here on Friday to talk about saving money and avoiding scams. Your assignment was to track your own spending with an eye to finding the leaks where all the money trickles away, right? So start today if you haven't already and tune in on Friday. This was originally going to be Thursday, but now it'll be Friday with Deyanira Del Rio for ideas on how to save. Now, this past weekend, to little notice, the largely pro-Israel think tank, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, proposed maps of the West Bank and land swaps that would let Israel keep 80% of settlement residents while providing the Palestinians contiguous territory. Then on Monday, to enormous notice, the Palestine papers leaked to Al Jazeera revealed that the Palestinians were ready to cede all but one of the Jerusalem settlements to the Israelis. So are we done now? David Makovsky, director of the Washington Institute's Project on the Middle East Peace Process and co-author with former Clinton Middle East negotiator Dennis Ross of Myths, Illusions, and Peace, Finding a New Direction for America in the Middle East. David Makovsky joins me now. Hi there.
Good to be with you, Brian.
First, what made you do this series of maps to propose a series of land swaps between the Israelis and Palestinians on your own at the think tank? Was it a lack of movement in official negotiations?
Well, I think it's timely now because there's no pretense of progress in the talks. But frankly, the goal was to demystify where does demography meet geography in the West Bank? Because I feel that we've had this debate forever, but it's always like at a 50,000 feet level. And I literally wanted to bring this debate down to earth by letting people know that there was a way to square this circle, that each side's core demands were actually mutually accommodating, that you could have the Palestinians having 100% of the West Bank and Israel keeping 80% of the settlers. Now, you wonder, how is that possible? Well, the insight was that those 80% basically live in less than 5% of the land, largely adjacent to the old 1967 boundary. And therefore, if you could find what we call land swaps, which are offsetting parcels of land inside Israel, then whatever Israel keeps, Israel gives. And so this way, the Palestinians could say, we're not being singled out. We have our dignity. We're getting what the Egyptians, the Jordanians, and what Israel's offering to the Syrians, which is 100% of the land. So we're not being singled out or discriminated against. And the Israelis could say, that's correct. And at the same time, 80% of the settlers who live in that 5% would be no more in a limbo status, but they would be upgraded, and they would basically be part of Israel. So we wanted to show that the impossible was attainable.
Who have you presented this to, and how is it received?
Well, I met with President Abbas and his advisors. I met with all of Prime Minister Netanyahu's advisors. I met with Shimon Peres. I met with others on the Israeli side and on the Palestinian side. I'm in a little bit of a quandary here because these were off-the-record sessions. Let's just say I was very pleased by the response I got from both sides. But I think to give more detail will put people's backs in the corner, and it's not really helpful.
Was it any of your own material and their response to it that was leaked in these Palestine papers,
so-called,
Al Jazeera has?
No, but you could say what's the thread between these two developments of this week? One was the release of the maps, which the Sunday New York Times did a very nice piece about, and your listeners could go online and read it in the Sunday paper. And these other these Palestine papers, the common thread that run between both of these ideas is what I would call conditioning, is a sense that both sides be aware of what is possible and what is not. On the Palestine papers, there's virtually nothing new there. But it was sensationalized and hyped by Al Jazeera, that is always out to embarrass the Palestinian Authority. But whatever their motivation, I think the fact is that it conditions people to what we already know, which is that both sides see a pathway for accommodation, if they like. So that conditioning, I think, has a silver lining.
And a lot of what did raise eyebrows from the Palestine Papers was the willingness of the Palestinian Authority to make just this kind of land swap. So giving parts of very Jewish-populated now East Jerusalem, for example, to Israel in exchange for more Palestinian-populated areas of the West Bank that would help create a contiguous Palestinian state.
Right.
And some people are outraged by that. Some people were just outraged among Palestinians that they weren't told more along the way of the kind of thing that was being considered in terms of a land swap. So do you think the release of the Palestine Papers helps or hurts the cause of a peace agreement that actually includes this kind of thing?
Well, I think that, since Bill Clinton put out his parameters in December 23rd, I think it was, the year 2000, this idea of Jewish neighborhoods for Israel and Jerusalem and Arab neighborhoods for Arabs has been out there. And all these, there's been so many memoirs of participants who are out there, and some of it's been translated into Arabic. People have been following it closely. They should know that this is out there. But Al Jazeera hyped it as this a massive Palestinian concession that they've unearthed, when in fact this was a decades-old story. So it'll put the PA on the first blush on the defensive. But since all this material is really known, I think it's going to – I would hope we'd have much more of a discussion about the people who are out to embarrass the Palestinian Authority, Al Jazeera, and saying, hey, why are you hyping something that's been basically known for a decade? This isn't about – betrayal. This is trying to work out a mutually accommodating resolution of this conflict.
I want to get in a few minutes to what you think about the pro-democracy demonstrations in Egypt now, spreading there from Tunisia, which just a few days ago was something that people predicted would not happen. But listeners, we can also open the phones, whether you're Israeli yourself or Palestinian yourself or anybody else who has a thought about the land swaps that were revealed in the Palestine Papers and also being worked on more overtly in along some similar lines by our guest. Do you think this makes Middle East peace more likely? Does it present more of a stumbling block? Do you like the basic idea if you're on either side of this? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for David Bukowski, who's the director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy's Project on the Middle East Peace Process and co-author with former Clinton peace negotiator Dennis Ross of Myths, Illusions, and Peace, Finding a New Direction for America in the Middle East, 212-433-WNYC. If you're considering yourself pro-Israel or pro-Palestinian or anything else, 212-433-9692. We spoke on Monday with Rami Khoury from the Daily Star in Lebanon, the American University in Beirut. The two of you have been on the show a number of times to discuss Middle East issues from a more Arab and more Jewish perspective. And what struck him was how desperate the Palestinians seemed and how this debunks the claim by the Israeli government that they have no negotiating partner, because the Palestinians really were offering all these things. Was that your reaction?
Yeah, well, like I said, I think that these items are known. To the extent that people will own up to their positions, I think we can make lemonade from lemons. I mean, what didn't start out as an intention to further the peace process might do more than anything else to actually maintain this conditioning. So I just hope the Palestinian Authority does not buckle under the publicity and owns up to it. And I think it's also important, as you just said, in the Israeli public opinion, that that is advertised more. Prime Minister Netanyahu, when he was at the White House in September, he says, I have a partner for peace. So I think this issue of partner, not partner, I think is not an issue anymore. I go back to Israel and Ramallah like every 3 months. 4 months, depends. And basically, you just see some fantastic developments on the ground on the Palestinian Authority side. Growth of like 9% at a time of a worldwide recession You're seeing new schools, I think 120 new schools being built, so kids are not going into double shifts where they couldn't go to school all day. A focus on social services, the security cooperation with Israel. For 3 years, there's been virtually no fatalities when, you know, during the Intifada, during the violence period in the first half of the decade, I think in 2002 alone, you had 410 Israelis killed from the West Bank. And you talk to senior Israeli and Palestinian security officials, and this is a golden age, what's going on right now. I know it's contrarian to your listeners who no one's ever gone broke being pessimistic about the Middle East, but the fact is that there is some good news. So people are used to hearing bad news out there. I apologize if I've ruined your day, but I think there's some interesting things going on, including the mosques where you had people who were agitating for suicide bombings. That doesn't happen anymore. Does that mean that we've reached a messianic point? No. More needs to be done on coexistence in school books on both sides. There's no question about that. And a bottom-up approach I just described will not be sustainable if it is not accompanied by a top-down negotiating process. Because if it's only bottom-up, it will look like trying to make an occupation more efficient, which is not the goal here. So it's a state-building enterprise, and I spent a lot of time with Prime Minister Fayyad, the Prime Minister of the Palestinians, and he said, you know, I'm taking a page out of the Zionist handbook. Look how the Jewish state was born from 1917 to 1948, the Balfour Declaration, until when the State of Israel was declared in 48. They built all these institutions, whether it was the Hebrew University, whether it was the Haganah Security Services, whether it was the Jewish Agency Government in exile, waiting. All these things were done then, so when they declared the state, they had built the state. And I think that's what the Palestinians are trying to do now. And the real news is that there's a – I would argue – I know this might be a controversial statement for some of your listeners, but I think there's a de facto alliance going on basically between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, because what happened with Hamas in Gaza, Palestinians don't want this coming to a theater near you in the West Bank. So, like, if you didn't like the book, you don't want to see the movie in the West Bank. So there's an effort here. And that's matched, which I think what Fayyad has done a fantastic job, what I would call a culture of accountability. And Arafat had much more of a culture of entitlement. We're not responsible for any institutions because we're occupied. And Fayyad's view is we have to be accountable to ourselves. We're not doing the world a favor. They're not doing it for us. We got to work for ourselves. And I think this is a real shift. And those two driving forces, whether it's a convergence of interest because of Gaza or a culture of accountability, they give us hope where we have not seen hope. But in and of itself, I want to say it's not going to work unless the bottom-up meets the top-down negotiations.
David Makovsky, our guest from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Let's get a couple of callers in. Ellen in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Excuse me. Hi.
Hi. This is all a revelation to me. Maybe I don't follow it closely enough, but I don't understand what your guest means when he says that Al Jazeera wants to embarrass the Palestinians. I don't understand if Al Jazeera is to the left or the right of the Palestinians. Could he please help us a little on that?
Thank you, Ellen.
Look, I'm glad you asked that question. Al Jazeera has been very supportive of Hamas and often of Iranian nuclear claims as well. And when I go to Ramallah, I used to see everyone watching Al Jazeera. But now when I go, they're all watching Al Arabiya, which is a rival station. They're not yet watching the U.S. government station, Al Hura, but they're watching Al Arabiya. And I asked them, what about Al Jazeera? They go, oh, no, that's Hamas TV or Iran TV. We don't like that. And while Al Jazeera will once in a while put Israelis on there to show that they're trying to cover all sides, they have always been really trying to stick it to the Palestinian Authority as too pro-Western, too pro-Israeli, and Hamas is the station, I think, is the movement where they have coddled them.
Carmel in Forest Hills, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I was actually going to disagree about this being old news, in that in Israel there very much still is an argument about whether or not there's a partner internally, and that's very much how Lieberman gets to get where he is.
That's not Joe Lieberman, for people who don't know. That's Yigdal Lieberman.
Victor.
Victor Lieberman, the foreign minister, I guess, of Israel under Netanyahu right now.
Right.
I would
who built his whole case, and you actually heard that in the UN, and again in his various press conferences, that the Palestinians don't actually have.
That they're not a partner for peace, and I have to get a response now because our time is short. But you were saying before, David, that Netanyahu himself declared that he does have a partner for peace.
Right.
And are they giving different messages to the Israeli people from the prime minister and the foreign minister?
Yeah, I mean, at the time that Netanyahu was at the White House talking about the importance of a two-state solution, Avigdor Lieberman was at the UN General Assembly saying, my own prime minister's ideas will never work. America, we're used to a presidential system here where what the president says goes. But Israel, it's coalition politics, and you always try to cobble together enough parties to support the government. So here you have a foreign minister who outwardly contradicts the prime minister.
I want to get your take on what's going on in Egypt right now. Protests. Now, today, crackdown on protests. Twitter and Facebook are now blocked in Egypt after, from what I read, 87,000 people registered through social networking sites that they had participated in protests in the last couple of days. Are you shocked?
Look, what's amazing is the role of social media. You know, in the old days, if you took over the radio station, the television station, you could stage a coup. Now, the state cannot suppress the way it could because of all these alternative forms of communication like Facebook and Twitter. So it's a new era. This is going to be, though, much different than Tunisia because here the Muslim Brotherhood is very strong in Egypt, which it is not in Tunisia. And basically, I think you're going to see the army, the government elite, the business community all rally around the regime because they feel the alternative to the regime is an Islamist theocracy bringing them to the 12th century. So and Egypt has a history. I don't know. I won't say it's uninterrupted since the pharaohs, but of a centralized state. But it's a big country with tens and tens of millions of people all over. And the regime is very strong. So I don't think – and also for the United States, our equities are different. It's been – we've seen the Egyptian government as basically our main Arab ally along with the Saudis in the region.
But hasn't this been sort of America's – you know, one of America's sins in the Middle East is that because dictatorships like Egypt and Ben Ali in Tunisia, because they've been seen as allies of the United States and with respect to Egypt, to some degree, you know, with Israel after the peace deal in the 70s. As a result of that, the United States has coddled these dictators rather than promoting democracy. And we're seeing the backlash of that maybe on 9/11 and in a million other ways.
Agreed. I mean, I think what's happened is that we haven't been able to stick to a steady course. For like 9 months, year or so, or maybe a year, George Bush in the second term spoke out saying he was pro-democracy. As soon as Hamas won in Gaza, we stopped talking about it. I think we need a steady course, which is not to say the only definition of democracy is elections in tomorrow morning versus doing zero. There has to be a way that we are steadily and unswervingly supporting things like a free judiciary, for women's rights, media rights, all the institutions that you need that would culminate in an election. You don't want to use liberal means to get an illiberal result because the only people that are organized sometimes in that part of the world are the Muslim Brotherhood.
So what happens tomorrow in Egypt?
Well, I don't see the regime just fading into the night.
Tunisia did.
Right. No, I think this is going to be a different thing. The army is really going to fight hard because they think standing between them and the Muslim Brotherhood is the abyss. Now, the pictures that Americans we see on television are not of Islamists, and we hope that that this will lead to a liberal outpouring. But I hope that it leads us to tell this regime, you've got to get your act together. You've got to find a middle course where you open up and liberalize your institutions and become more inclusive.
And could this actually be bad for the democracy movement in Tunisia that this is happening in Egypt now, because the world's media attention is going to come off of Tunisia and onto Egypt?
That's an interesting way of looking at it. It's possible. I happened to meet with an Arab foreign minister 2 days ago, and I said, where does this go next? He said there are a lot of countries that are very nervous. And if it leads them to open up a bit, I think that's a good thing.
All right. David Makovsky, director of the Middle East of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He is co-author with former Clinton Middle East negotiator Dennis Ross of Myths, Illusions, and Peace, Finding a New Direction for America in the Middle East. And he was here to deliver sort of the good news that he hopes the release of the Palestine Papers, as well as his own maps of possible land swaps, helps to condition people on both sides of that for that eventual peace agreement.
I just want to say to your listeners that on the www.washingtoninstitute.org, all the maps, the report is there. It's all with Google Earth, and so you could help bring this debate down to earth by downloading it and reading it and playing with the maps and seeing it all for yourself. Don't take my word for it.
Great. David, thanks a lot. And if that made you smile, at least a little, keep that smile on your face, because when we come back in a minute, we will look at the new research that reveals what's happening in our brains when our mouths turn up. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.